Senator Wilikowski and Senator Cowdery and Senator Kukesh are here for the purposes of the committee. And the purpose of the committee today is a Transportation Committee briefing on the Alaska Railroad. And if you would like to come forward and introduce yourself for the record, please. We appreciate your testimony and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Pat Gamble. I'm the President and CEO of the Alaska Railroad Corporation. I've been with the company now for about 6 years. And on my left is our CFO, Mr. Bill O'Leary. I bring Bill along if you all want to peel back the onion into our finances. I will defer to Bill, and we were prepared to answer any technical questions that you might have in that area as well. A word about the briefing. I don't want to scare everybody off with a bunch of PowerPoints, but when we came down, we knew our mission was to talk economic development, to talk transportation in a separate committee, and that there were a number of new legislators that we had not talked to before. So I tried to build two briefings that kind of covered the waterfront a little bit. This one is the transportation-oriented briefing. It's got a little bit of economic development in it. The other one was more economic development, had a little bit more industrial and transportation in it. So you're getting the one that's designed to go to this committee, but it presents a little bit broader and some more background than I would normally give if I were coming down for the second or third time to talk about the railroad. So I'll just make a couple of points, high points on these charts, and I think in your own time, some of the facts I won't go over because they speak for themselves, and would be certainly glad to answer any questions later on for the record if they come up from either yourselves or your staff. So I'll just refer to the page number and we'll flip the pages. On page two, history of the railroad. Can't really start a discussion about the railroad unless we give it a little bit of Alaska history, and you have that on page two. The bottom right-hand corner on page three, particularly for new folks and even for folks that we haven't talked to for a while, we need to remind them that that while it's a state-owned public corporation, we operate as a rather semi-autonomously as a private corporation would. We don't have classic stockholders in the sense, but in fact, we are flexible within our guidelines in the Railroad and Alaskan and Federal Transfer Acts to be able to act relatively independently, to be able to match and meet market demands that any private or public corporation would need to do. We have a board of directors. They are a management board, and that's a little bit different. In other words, they actually delegate management of the railroad on a day-to-day basis to me and my staff, but they are responsible for management of the railroad. So they get into our knickers just a little bit more detail than most normal corporate boards would. They're not under Sarbanes-Oxley, but we operate very closely along those lines. Now, as such, as I said, the thing that really distinguishes us is the fact that our employees' retirement system and their post-retirement medical, for example, is all paid for out of railroad earnings. We don't take any money from the state, from the general fund, and likewise, we don't pass anything back to the state. In fact, by law, dollars earned by the railroad are specifically supposed to be spent and kept by the railroad. And so we, instead of putting money back into stockholders, put everything back into capital and everything back into the railroad itself. That can either be financial or it can be beneficial value that returns back to the state. We think, as far as we know, that we're still the only remaining railroad in the United States that offers full year-round regularly scheduled passenger and freight service. That has some pluses, mainly for the state because we provide transportation services. Senator Wilken.
Excuse me, just for the record, I'd like to note that Senator Wilken has joined us. And we started late. We were waiting for Donnie Olson to come down from a bill signing, so we just started a few minutes ago.
Okay, thank you. Hi, everybody. Hi, General.
Did you have a comment you wanted to ask?
I noticed on this page three that it says you don't receive any funds from the state. How much do you receive from the feds a year?
Well, of course, that changes every year, but what's the total number?
For 2007, we're anticipating roughly $45 million, I believe.
Okay. We figure it takes about $36 million overall a year just to keep the railroad the lights on and the railroad operating. That's just to pay everybody and keep the railroad going, no capital investment, no upgrades, so on and so forth. So as I said, any improvements we want to make, it really depends upon what we can, what pots we can find that we're eligible to dip into on the federal side as a result of moving passengers primarily. And then our net earnings and depreciation go back in and add to that, and that is our capital program, which will run about $100 million this year.
Do you have the same problem as other state, you know, on the PERS and TERS, you know, events?
I'm going to address that in a following chart, but the answer is no on the PERS, and we're about to get out of it on the post-retirement medical side, and we'll show you some numbers on that.
Thank you.
Classic organizational structure there on chart number 6. Chart number 7, it shows you who's on our board, and we've got some new names on there. And you can see there, John Binkley's back on the board. John was gone for almost a year. Commissioner Noddy is new. Commissioner Shaven is new. Ori Williams has been with us. Jack Burton is our labor representative, and he's been on the board for quite some time. And then Mayor Menard just joined us. They had their first board meeting in January.
How do you compensate your board?
The board is
and
compensated.
At what level?
$400 a day for each work day they work with the railroad. Mm. And that obviously breaks down. I mean, if somebody comes in and spends a couple hours or 3 hours versus a day, and but in general, the law, the Transfer Act, actually stipulates that $400 a day, and that hasn't changed since 1985.
Okay.
The chart number 8, again, pretty standard stuff. We emphasize, again, the balance between freight and passenger and customer service on both sides, and we're a little different breed of cat with that respect, because optimizing the bottom line is what the railroads in the lower 48 have done, and they did it with freight. They didn't do it with passengers. We, on the other hand, are making money on passenger service, and we're proud of that, but it also has a margin to it that's not as good as the margin that we make off freight. So that's a trade-off that we make to be able to move passengers year-round. And it is the face of the railroad. In truth, the face of the Alaska Railroad within the state and also outside the state on web pages and films and so on and so forth, they don't show freight trains. They show the Alaska Railroad passenger service, and we're real proud of that. Chart number 9, again, some statistics. Same for chart number 10. The point I'd make on chart number 10 is to remind everyone about the interface we have at Tidewater with our docks. We have quite an operation at Whittier, both freight and passenger pickup. We have passenger docking at Seward. We have some small passenger docking in Whittier, but the large ships, some of them still dock in Seward. We have rail now that goes down into the port of Anchorage and will extend even farther when the port expands. And then we have a dock in Seattle that our barge is the other end of our ocean-going barge service. And we have a dock right there in the harbor in Seattle where the cars get loaded. Chart number 11, sources of revenue. This chart has not changed much over the years other than the growth in passengers. The growth in passengers has probably changed 5% in the time that I've been on the railroad. It's a real success story. Chart number 6 gives you an idea of what I call our... Yes, sir.
I noticed the real estate, you got the source of revenue of 10%. Has that changed? I mean, I thought the real estate was a big source of revenue for the railroad.
I think you're referring to the net earnings is quite often referred to as being all real estates, because it so happens that real estate's earnings and the net earnings on the railroad in years past were about the same. And so people used to characterize the railroad as, well, you could stop running trains and just run real estate and make the same net earnings. That's not the case today. That number stayed about the same. It stayed pretty flat over the years.
As a percentage, anyway.
As a percentage, yes. Chart number 12 is designed to kind of give you a feeling for what our operational tempo is. In other words, what are the moving parts and how much is moving over the railroad? I talk about our passenger service. We actually did start winning a number of awards, and we've been in a number of films, and as opposed to when we started, when Bill and I started, we were losing money on passenger service, and frankly, there was discussion about cutting some of that service, which we unfortunately tried to do one time, and the wrath of the cabin folks north of Talkeetna descended on us, and we decided we wouldn't try that again. But now, really, the passenger service is doing very, very well. Chart 13, again, pretty standard stuff. Breaks down in our freight operation the different components. TOFC is trailers on flat cars. And COFC is containers on flat cars. Trailer on flat cars, where they actually take the back of the rig and put it up, wheels and all, up on the car itself, as opposed to just the container.
If I could ask, yeah. On this coal, do you actually make a profit on coal, or do you subsidize it to a certain amount?
No, we make a profit on coal. It's pretty slim on export coal right now, historically. Now, there are some actions that are ongoing that may improve that for export coal, we're waiting to see, that are in the hopper right now. Local coal has a better margin to it.
And what do you get, say, from Isabella to Seward? How much a ton does that run?
I'd really rather not say for the record, Senator, if I could avoid that question and maybe get with you privately to answer that question.
Okay.
It gets a little bit into the business, and there's competitors that would like to know that number as well. And
okay.
I'd be happy to give it to you, or Mr. Chairman, with your permission, or privately.
Thank you.
The real estate department on chart 14, it's actually a growing business. We've gotten much more into developing the docks in Whittier, and we're doing work in Seward. And then facilities, we've reorganized the facilities department, and we've taken from cradle to grave a different look at, rather than just collecting lease dollars, we actually have assigned all the railroad real property to the facilities department to include management, upgrade, maintenance, and so on, and the associated expense that goes with that. So we've rearranged the real estate department considerably from the past few years. The theme for our last board meeting, and the theme that I used when reporting to the legislature, is I went back 6 years, because that's when I came on board the railroad. And it was useful because the first year that Bill and I, for example, and quite a few of the members of the railroad senior management team, we kind of took stock of the railroad in the first year to figure out what it is needed doing. And then we put in place a five-year program. Well, we've just completed that first five-year program. So we're measuring our results against what it was we were when we started. 2007, we're going to be doing stock taking again to figure out where we are now at the completion of the first five-year program. And we will set in place by the end of 2007 the second five-year program. And so that tends to be the theme to my employees and to anybody I'm talking to right now. And it's useful for comparison purposes to show what we've succeeded at and where we need to do better. So I'll be using that theme through the remainder of the briefing. We were in the process of identifying the fact that the main line was pretty much, in terms of a piece of infrastructure, in trouble. Senator Stevens had come forward and began earmarks annual appropriations that started out at about $10 million. And the railroad had just begun breaking ground for its first projects that it could fund with some of that federal money. But we had a lot to do. The track, the bridges, the sidings couldn't take the new locomotives. They were too big and too heavy. And a lot of the facility was either in poor repair, risky, or unusable altogether. We had equipment problems, and we didn't know how much equipment we really needed, how to get rid of the old stuff, and whether to buy new stuff. We were really not very programmatic in that sense. we were kind of flush with the idea that we're going to get new cash. We've got federal dollars that are entitlement. We can spend these dollars. Where do we want to spend them? And we kind of looked around because we had to get to spending in order to show that we could process these dollars and be accountable. But it was not very programmatic. And so one of the things we needed to do was take stock, as I said in that first year, and get more programmatic so that we could line it out in the future capital investments. Our safety record, if you recall back then, was not good at all. And in fact, when I was hired, that was the first thing that I was instructed was to take this on as the number one priority. And we didn't have a culture of safety. In fact, the culture was, well, you got to take a few losses in a big game. This is rough, tough work. Conditions are bad, but we know how to do it better than anybody else, but you take a few hits in a big game. And obviously, you don't have a great safety program with that kind of an attitude. And we had to deal with that. We didn't have a lot of witting technologists. We had people who understand that there's technology out there, but there was no really real effort to try to apply it to tasks on the railroad. And of course, technology can be a money pit and it can be expensive. Again, programmatically, we needed to get our act together. And so on, you can see the items there. Slide 18 goes into a little more detail about the technology. All kinds of things out there for us to pick and choose from, but we just hadn't taken the steps to go after any of it. I mentioned facilities on slide 19. We didn't even really know what a facility was by definition. We didn't know how much we owned. I'm not sure we even knew what our assets breakout, the worth of our assets really was. And most of it was in poor repair. The track was getting whatever money the railroad could put down, and the facilities weren't getting any money at all because there was no facilities program. Slide number 20 talks about equipment. As I said, we didn't have a definition, for example, what's the service life of a locomotive? How many miles and how many years do you run one until you figure you've got to replace it? I mean, we hadn't gone through that process. We were starting to see growth in the passenger side, but we didn't know if we needed to buy more coaches and what was the methodology to determine if we did. We were not doing those kinds of calculations programmatically.
Does the railroad own all the passenger coaches?
It does. You know, we haul by contract, but anything that's painted blue and gold, we own.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at some of these shortfalls that were there, I'm assuming prior to you coming on board, especially related to the safety record, the worn-out equipment, the facilities with no inventory or no formal inventory that you can point to, I almost feel like there's a level of incompetence that's there. And is that indeed, or am I misreading this?
No, I would not call it incompetence. I would call it, this is the leftover legacy of the federal days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when employees have to earn their money in order to get the benefits back to them, there's an incentive there that was not there in the federal days when they were just issued a budget. And they were issued a budget by a government that had long since made up its mind that it was going to divest itself of the Alaska Railroad. And so it was putting no capital dollars into that railroad as it attempted to try to figure out how to sell it off and get rid of it. And so I would put the blame squarely at a very explicit decision to hold down the capital investment in the railroad because they thought it was going to sell. When you go through several years of that, even though we bought it in 1985, that whole attitude just drifted over. And the railroad was poor as a church mouse. It wasn't making much money until Governor Sheffield came along and actually started making money and started turning this whole idea around that we're a business, that we're not just waiting for a budget, and that when you spend it and it's gone, there is no more. If you talk to some of the old heads about the days of federal ownership and not too long after that, this attitude prevailed for quite a time, and I think really put the railroad in the predicament that it was and set up probably in the 90s some of the unfortunate situations that happened.
Mr. Chairman, with all due respect, General, if I was, and a number of us up here at the table are business people, if this is to be run as a business, it was taken over as a business, and somebody gave me this type of a framework to go and look at and an audit was done, I would say that there is a level of incompetence here that is not acceptable by the standards of good business practice.
Well, I agree that if there's something this wrong, there needs to be accountability.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is either someone or something accountable. Now, my take on that is the explanation that I just gave you.
Okay.
I've looked back, I've looked at notes, I've looked at my predecessors. I'm satisfied they dealt the best they could with what they had at the time. And, you know, we talk about, we beat our chest and say, well, we don't take any money from the state. Back in those days, I think they'd been happy to get dollars anywhere they could because things were in such poor shape. And even though they probably wanted, from what I could tell, to do a lot of the things that we had the luxury of doing, they didn't have the wherewithal to pull it off. When Governor Bill Sheffield finally was recognized in Washington as an entitlement and got the railroad dollars coming in as an entitlement, then actual plans could be set in motion. And then he and I transitioned right about that time. And since that time, we've actually picked up several more pots of money or increased the ones that we've got. So I have it a lot better than they had back in those days, and that's a nice position to be in. And I don't take anything away from the guys that were trying the best they could back then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, that sets the stage. The one other item on number 21, you know, people make it happen, and there were a lot of problems in that area too. So the point of this group of charts is to kind of let you know what that assessment in 2001 looked like in our view. Everywhere we turned, we had a mountain to climb, and it was almost overwhelming. We've come down the road 5 years, and let me talk a little bit about what's happened in that period of time. On slide number 23, at the top of the page there, of page 12, you see the financial trends where I've done a little bit of comparison. 2002 was the first year of the five-year plan, and I just lay this out to kind of show you, by comparison, the growth in the railroad since that time. Slide number 24 examines that growth pattern as a result of some percentages, another way to look at the same sort of thing. Talks a little bit about the fact that with the locomotive plan that we did put together, we're now running about 50% of our newest and most powerful locomotives. We have four more coming. That'll probably push us with some sales of some older ones that we have made and will make. We'll probably go to about 80% all of new model locomotives. And then the passenger coaches, either new, rebuilt, or refurbished, we're running about 35% with what we have on the books right now, being basically either rebuilt or brand new. So we've been able to apply those capital dollars. Now, in the application, with that many different areas to address, it's very, very hard to pick your priorities. And so from a philosophical point of view, we adopted what we call a balanced program. We said we're not going to rob Peter to pay Paul. We're going to make the decision that money is going to flow across the railroad to all our needs. We're not just going to channel it into what we consider to be the most important thing. There was an exception, and that was safety. And I can talk about that a little bit more. But even with safety, there's critical and urgent safety needs, and then there's just safety. So we are building over this five-year period what I like to call a balanced program, where even somebody in a shop that's badly in need of a brand new lunchroom or break room that's a grease pit someplace, when we go in and fix that shop up, those folks see that and they think somebody out there actually knows we're here. And we felt it was very, very important to send those signals across the railroad in every department that we could and bring everybody up. We weren't in a rush. We didn't have stockholders wanting quarterly reports, and we could afford to take our time and do it the way the business school lectures would tell you to do it. On slide number 25, capital spending for 2006, pretty healthy number. And 2006 was the first year that the legislature granted us approval to sell tax-free bonds that we put specifically into the main line of the railroad, and we've executed the first year of a program out through 2012 to rebuild the remaining rail line that has not been rebuilt. And we received approval to spend up to $165 million worth of bonds, and we sold the first increment of those bonds and executed the first year of the program in 2006. To answer the question, Senator, that you asked about benefits on slide number 26, the pension fund totaled $66 million in the railroad at the end of 2006, which is up $9 million from the previous year. Right now, I mean, this changes day to day, obviously, but right now, in round numbers, the funding exceeds our liability by $9.5 million. On the medical side...
Excuse me, we have a couple of questions.
I'm sorry?
Yeah. Wilkowski?
Yeah, thank you. So if I heard you correctly, you're actually overfunded on your pensions?
Yes.
Is it a federal pension plan, or is that...
Railroad pension plan. It's not federal.
Okay. Guaranteed by the federal government?
No, Senator. It is not subject to ERISA. It is a governmental pension plan, very similar in nature to the state's PERS and TERS program.
If I could just follow up. Is that guaranteed by the... protected by the Alaska Constitution?
I don't know. I don't know. I think it, as a public pension plan, I believe it is, but I couldn't answer authoritatively on that.
Okay. Where are you at in your collective bargaining process? Do you have negotiated agreement with all your units?
We are constantly in negotiation with five different unions. Like, for example, right now we just completed one negotiation. We're in the middle of a long negotiation with another union, and we'll be starting another negotiation before too long. So we actually overlap in some cases.
And just, I've had some concerns relayed to me by constituents who work for the railroad about the negotiation process, and just about, I don't want to get into the collective bargaining process here. I know it's a employer-employee deal, but I just have had concerns from people in my district who were concerned about the negotiation process that was occurring.
I think you're referring to the union that we call the ARW, and basically that's the track laborers, because they've been in negotiation now for over a year. The concern probably is coming from the negotiators, not from the rank and file. The rank and file have been very quiet. The reason was because the last time we negotiated with them, all we did was negotiate wages, and we reached a very amenable settlement with them and made them happy. And so the rank and file are still taking advantage of that wage settlement. The only offering on the table that we agreed to, we let them pick three subjects. This was, what, 2 years ago?
2 years ago.
2 years ago. So their chairman came in and said, the three subjects are wages, wages, and wages. We said, fine. We reached a negotiation with them. And so the rank and file have been pretty happy for the last 2 years. The leadership is frustrated because this negotiation... they thought it was going to be a very quick, simple negotiation. We, in fact, went in with a whole list of work rules issues, because this contract, in our opinion, was the result of many years of hanging things on it, and we wanted to clean it up. I think we had something like 58 items, which is huge for a normal negotiation. We're down to over 80% of those items being tentatively agreed to. We're down to the last eight. But it's taken a year to get there, and I think, and I feel their frustration too. I don't fault them for complaining, and we'll get through it. We'll get through it, okay.
Thank you.
Senator Cowdery?
Yeah, on this slide 29, I notice you're putting some concrete ties in, and in lieu of wood. Where do you get your wood ties from? Are they from Alaska wood, or is it outside?
Everything comes from outside.
And the concrete ties is in Asia and a lot of other places, pretty much all concrete ties. And as I understood, the ties are not straight like regular wood ties. They go in a curve to keep the sway out and help for higher speed. Is that true?
That's exactly right. There are two manufacturers of concrete ties in the lower 48. Both of them have a proprietary process where the formation, the angles, the rebar setting are highly specific because of the forces that those ties take. Without, they're not resilient like a wood tie is, like a hardwood tie is. So and we buy our ties from those companies in lower 48.
What's the life of a tie?
The life of a contract tie is yet to be determined because nobody's lived with one that long.
Yeah.
But it's probably 100 years. A hardwood tie, red cedar or red oak, is probably well. We dictate the life of our own ties. We want a cycle program that doesn't have a tie get over 40 years, preferably 35.
Okay.
And with that new bonding, we're on that cycle now. We've just started at that level. We had ties that were well over 45 years on the railroad before we went in and started reworking it.
The attachment to the wood tie to the rail is different than the concrete tie to the rail, right?
The concrete ties have a different snubber than the wood ties do with the spikes.
Well, if they're not Alaska ties, it seems like to me we should get as many concrete ties in the system as possible.
Well, you know, Senator, we don't interchange them. We actually put the concrete ties on the curves.
Yeah, I know.
Because that's where the wear and tear and the exchange of energy between wheels and rails occurs, and the concrete tie stabilizes that and actually reduces the energy exchange, which is wear and tear. So any curve over 6 degrees, we're putting concrete ties on. And then of course, Healy Canyon is almost all curves, and we just finished this summer almost rebuilding the entire Healy Canyon stretch of the railroad with concrete ties.
Thank you.
I was on slide 26, and I just wanted to mention there that the second half of our retiree benefits are post-retirement medical. The railroad had not elected to fund post-retirement medical for, in every year of the transfer except one, and it had put about $700,000 in an account, but that was the only year they put any money in post-retirement medical. We were building up a liability there, an obligation that was getting very large. And so last year and this year, we began putting significant dollars of our earnings into post-retirement medical. And I think it's in the other briefing. There's a chart that broke that out more clearly, but we've put, Bill, seven?
Almost over $8 million in
the last 2 years. I mean, that could have gone to bottom line. And net earnings and capital investment or whatever, we put it into the employee program, and we think that within 3 years we'll have that program whole along with the retirement. The thing I'll say about safety, I won't go on and on about safety. I think our track record speaks for itself. You can see on slide 27, I've got some percentages there under the title Progress since 2001. You can look up and see some of the awards that we've received in the safety area. 2006 was our best year ever with our overall safety program, and this is the fourth time in 5 years I've been able to say that. So I think of all the things that I'm most proud of is the employee buy-in to the realization that safety is the business of the railroad, very much the business of the railroad, and it only makes things better for them, and we've turned that culture problem around.
Senator Wilkowski
Thank
has
you.
A question for you.
Have you had any problems with occupational diseases, carpal tunnel syndrome, hearing problems, or lung disease?
No. We have not had problems. I'm not saying that there isn't an odd case where one of them might have popped up that probably wouldn't even reach my attention. So I'm sure a carpal tunnel, for example, has gone into the doctors or something like that. But as a problem that it's raised to a level where we need to address it. Now hearing, we've got to be very careful because we've got a lot of industrial areas where hearing and hearing protection is very, very important. And so we make sure our employees are protected on the hearing side. And so that one is one we actively engage in, absolutely. And lung disease, no. We have a problem with smoke in the shops in the wintertime. We call it Project Blue Smoke to get that out of there. And we've invested significant capital dollars in analyzing what we can do to those old 1940 shops. And rather than just move the air around with fans, actually duct the air out. And we've invested in ventilation systems now that are doing that, both in Fairbanks and the shops in Anchorage. So we think we've got a pretty good handle on that one, too. Slide 29, I mentioned the bonds. There's a little bit underneath that item that shows you what we're using the money for and some of the progress we've made. Slide 30, I won't go into any detail on this, but I will say that, and I've talked to several of you before about this, we are still working on what we call our collision avoidance system. And it's pricey, but it's probably worth the investment if we can avoid one collision. And you know, in the lower 48, you've seen what happens. Those collisions take all kinds of bad shapes, especially if you're carrying hazardous cargo and you've got to evacuate a town, or worse yet, you have deaths involved. In a nutshell, what collision avoidance does and what that chart there shows you is we've got a satellite, we've got a GPS locator on the track vehicles. It talks to the satellite, and every other track vehicle knows where every other track vehicle is through the computer. The switches are involved. Switches have to be aligned the proper way. If a switch is misaligned into a siding and a train's coming along at 45 miles an hour and can't stop and shoots into the siding at a speed that's designed to be 10 miles an hour, that's derailment territory. And if something's sitting on the siding, you have a disaster like we had on the East Coast a couple of years ago with the chlorine. This system will identify the position of the switches, and if nothing's done, and it calculates the speed of the moving train and the weight of the train and the stopping distance of the train under its conditions, if nothing's done in a certain time, it will actually take control away from the vehicle and stop it prior to it meeting another vehicle or a switch or whatever the authority is. And then you've got to do a fast, typically it's like a reboot in order to gain control back over the locomotive to be able to go on. If we get this fielded, it'll probably be in early 2009, maybe late 2008. If we get this fielded, we'll probably be the first operational railroad to have this system in place in the United States.
Excuse me, Senator Wilkin has a question.
Yes, sir. You might have just answered it. So, Pat, are you modeling it after an existing collision avoidance system in the States?
No, we are breaking trail.
Okay. Absolutely. How much do you think you'll have invested by 2009? Rough numbers.
We'll be pushing $20 million overall.
Really?
Maybe a little less. And that isn't the whole thing. If we do the whole railroad with all the switches and all the vehicles, and that includes our maintenance trucks with high rail wheels on them, we can put a box in them too. So you got a locomotive coming and a truck coming. If we do all of it, we'll probably be in the $40 million range.
Thank you.
Senator Olson has a question for you.
Has there been a problem with accidents of this sort that this CAS is supposed to avoid in the past?
Absolutely. In the lower 48, there have been a number of really messy accidents. The switches were the biggest ones because it affected a whole piece of a train. And in the case of the Canadian train, it rolled into a big lake that was a pristine lake, and the Canadian National just caught all kinds of grief over that one. In the case of, I think it was the Norfolk Southern, they were carrying chlorine. They got shunted off into a siding. There was a locomotive on the siding. They collided, killed a bunch of people. Chlorine was released. Town was evacuated. And then you don't hear about it, but most of the railroads I'm familiar with at one time or another over the last 5 years have hit one of their own maintenance vehicles on the track. They come around a curve, and there's a guy on a high rail up there working on the track. He was supposed to have been cleared off. Somehow communications got garbled or mixed up or didn't register right. It's usually a human error, communications error, and the train smacks into a truck.
I should have been more specific, Mr. Chairman. I should have been more specific with my question. I was asking about up here because it's my understanding that the way the trains operate in Canada, the way they operate in the lower 48, where you got bigger systems and different inherent problems with that are different than the system that we have up here, which is obviously a shorter run as well as more oversight from people that are just watching to see what's going on.
Well, we have what we call dark territory, and we have manual control with dispatchers. Mm-hmm. That issue a warrant, say you can go between this mile and this mile, and if you don't hear from them, you're not supposed to go beyond that mile. It's very archaic. It's the way trains have been doing it for years and years and years. It isn't any different than the lower 48. But I will tell you, as I sit here, knocking on wood, we've dodged several bullets over the years. I mean, we have dodged bullets. it's the nature of the beast. When you've got people involved and radio communications over long distances, they'll step on each other, they'll read some numbers backwards, somebody's not listening, that it came back backwards. We've had those mistakes happen. Luckily, we have not had an incident or an accident as a result of a collision. We had one little bump one time a couple of years ago. But all it takes is one, and with what it can generate potentially environmentally or within a community, downtown Wasilla, for example, the $40 million investment is worth it, I think, for the state.
Well, that is impressive if it's got no collision accidents.
Yes, Senator Wilken.
Thank you. Just a review, because I think you might have skipped over it. How many gallons of fuel are you hauling a day from North Pole to Anchorage?
In round numbers right now, we're doing about $700 million a year, so would be $1.6 million or something like that a day.
And those are in 100-car trains, two trains a day? Is that how that works?
In the winter, we're using one train. The refinery's kind of down. Actually, we've actually hauled more than that. When the refinery's up to full capacity, we're actually pushing 1 billion gallons a year. And that's two trains a day, and they're probably 80-car trains in that case, cycling back and forth. Now, we're right now working with Flint Hills at the refinery to improve our loading capacity up there so that we can load a 100-car train without having to break it all up in pieces and keep moving it through the Chapados siding and the rail yard and back into the refinery and all that ballet we go through. And we're actually working with them right now to refine that and smooth that out. But and as you know, they're not producing to their fullest capacity. They had plans to actually upgrade the refinery and even produce more product. But just about 3 years ago, I think we broke about 1 billion gallons.
I think that it's helpful for the committee to know that there's that much moving back and forth every day, because we forget that it's there, but you know, we in Fairbanks certainly see it, but the state doesn't see all that movement. And I mean, there's a huge liability and a huge potential for all sorts of problems. And if we're going to invest $20 million just to make sure we don't run into one another, that's just one piece. And if something did happen and we didn't have that, boy, shame on us. So, thank you.
Well, that's the way we feel. I mean, we think this investment is, it's not fun to break trail with technology, because it can be a black hole. I mean, you can go a long way and find out this isn't gonna work. And we've taken a chance. We have a couple folks on our staff who are very, very well versed in the technology. In fact, probably as good as anybody in the country. And so based on that, we've elected to go ahead and take this on ourselves, because we think it is worth the risk, both financially and certainly industrially worth the risk. I talked on slide 31 about the facilities program. A lot of work going on there. Slide 32, passenger service. Best passenger revenue season on record in 2006. We came up with a first-class service last year, and it's been a tremendous hit. We designed our own coaches with the help of our contractor, Colorado Railcar, and put those double-deckers in with the platform on the top deck and the nice dining room downstairs, and boy, that has really gone over, so we're building some more of those. Princess is evolving their growth and service, and we're doing that with them. We're very much in the partnership with Princess to see where we can go with the increase in the different offers that we can make to people who want to go by train. But a steady 3-5% passenger growth has been the name of the game, and 3 years ago we broke even. 2 years ago we started making money, and now we're very nicely profitable on our passenger service. And I talk a little bit about what the passenger growth in coaches looks like on slide 33. And then on slide 34 I talk about some of the things we're doing with the communities. If you look at our mission statement, up front in this briefing, our mission statement says that, you know, we want to be a partner in community and economic growth. That comes in a lot of flavors. And I just list a few of them right here on slide 34.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. What's the number of moose kills or wildlife kills you're averaging per year from trains?
We killed 50 last year. We are at 37 this year. We were at 39 this time last year. We've had two low years. I think the little sign in the hay flats as you come down off the hill as you're going north toward Wasilla is now on the highway, the Glen Highway. That kill number is up over 200 on the highway right there. But we've actually had a low year last year and a low year this year so far.
Anything that can be done to reduce that number? I'm sure you're looking at ways.
Well, there's a lot of history there that goes, and we can get you that history. It goes all the way back to the 90s about the things that the railroad has tried to do and has done. I think the biggest thing that we've been able to do is when they cut back the brush away from the main line, especially in the area north of Talkeetna. I can show you a matrix chart that will show you every moose kill by mile between Anchorage and Fairbanks. It goes all the way back to the mid-1980s. And clearly the zone is north of Talkeetna for I don't know, 50 miles, let's say. Cutting back the brush and then taking one of these big spreaders that clears the snow out and makes a nice wide right-of-way so that they don't have to get up on the tracks has done an awful lot to reduce the moose kill. And it gives them a way to get off the track when the train's coming, whereas in the old days, if you see the snow on both sides and kind of like a canyon, you know, the moose couldn't go anywhere. And I think that's had a lot to do with it. The weather has a lot to do with it. If you get a really deep snow going up north of Talkeetna, the moose kills in that area will go up.
If I could just follow up on a slightly different area. Having any problems with ATVs, snow machines on the tracks?
We do. The main problem, well, you know, you don't know what you don't know. In other words, I think there's probably lots of people that get on the tracks that we never see. The ones that we do see normally occur around a bridge where they're trying to get across the bridge and use the tracks. There's a couple of bridges in particular that have like at Talkeetna, they've got a pedestrian track that you can walk across that's hung onto the side of the rail bridge. Of course, there's no road on the other side. It just goes to trail. So people want to take an ATV over. Well, the problem is the ATV builders are building these things bigger and bigger and bigger, and finally they built them so big they can't get across the track on the side of the railroad bridge. So now what they want to do is get up on the track and drive over it on the track and then get off on the other side. That's illegal, it's dangerous, and we've had several instances last year and this year, for example, at one particular bridge where the train has had to throw into emergency. When it goes into emergency braking, depending on what kind of train it is, it can derail a train. And then you're derailing right on a salmon stream, you know. So it just takes one to have a disaster. So we've tried to work with the communities and see what we can do rather than just put up signs and threaten everybody. I think in this particular case, on this one bridge, the growth in demand and, in fact, the encouragement for people to take advantage of the recreational opportunities on the other side, if that's the way we're going to go, I think the railroad has an obligation to go in and redo the bridge. I mean, I don't think that's somebody else's problem. I think that's our problem. So I've asked my staff to look and see what a redesign that would allow the larger vehicles to get across would cost, and we're probably going to have to just take that one on.
Senator Wilkin.
Thank you. Pat, before we go beyond slide 33, would you spend the 2 minutes on the new DMU?
Sure. The DMU is called a diesel multiple unit. We just call it a DMU because I don't know what diesel multiple unit stands for, really. But DMU is what you see in that picture on slide 33. It's a beautiful piece of technology. It's got a 600 horsepower motor on each end of it. A transmission hooked up that'll allow that to pull one or two other cars at a pretty good clip. It's made by Colorado Railcar. This particular one is made by Colorado Railcar, who made some of our coaches. We are in a partnership with the Forest Service that want to open up the Chugach coming out of Portage. And you know, when you go around the end of the Turnigan and take the road up the highway, the parallel valley is where the train goes. And there's no other access into that valley other than by train. They want to open up that valley, and they want the railroad to to participate in taking visitors to the Chugach by train to a drop-off point up in the valley there by Spencer Glacier, if you're familiar with that area. It's before you get to Grandview. It's a real picturesque spot. They've got about a $15 million program to build huts and improve trails and connect them all the way. Ultimately, they'll connect all the way to Seward. And so this drop-off point is very nice for people who want to just take a day trip or people who want to go back into the Chugach and actually take their stuff and go back in there. So they asked us, would we be interested? And we said, yeah, we sure would, but we don't want to run a train up there to do that. You know, what we need is a commuter car. And they said, what if we get it for you? And they did. And we've got one being built. When that car comes to us, much like the one you see in the picture, we'll operate it in the summertime up to Spencer, back and forth for the Forest Service to carry people to their project. In the wintertime, they have no use for it, and part of the agreement is that we'll be able to use it in the local area at Anchorage. And what we're going to do is start experimenting with service between the airport, the Diamond Center, and the Old Depot. We hope to get a second one of these in the following year. We asked for two, and we think we're going to get supported for two. I can see us in a short time doing excursions down to Girdwood in the wintertime for skiing and to the valley and sort of testing what the public's desires might be in the wintertime to start with for the use of these cars. And we're kind of open to suggestions on this. But what it really does is it takes us one step closer to sort of inoculating folks with what it's like to commute, transit instead of recreation. And that's sort of where we're going.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, just a comment. I know when I was on Anchorage Planning and Zoning Commission, we spent a lot of time in our long-range transportation plan talking about commuter options and trying to figure out ways to relieve traffic. And I think it's a great idea, personally, to test something like that out, a commuter rail between Mat-Su and Anchorage, for instance, and perhaps from Anchorage to Girdwood, and see what kind of response you get from that. Instead of going ahead and investing huge amounts in it right up the front, I think it's a great idea.
Well, we're gonna need some support. You know, when we come out, I think publicly we've kind of got to get the word out to make sure people understand what it is we're trying to do, and where we're trying to orient people to pick up the pace in terms of whether or not we really are ready for commuting or whether we're just talking. We think there's a buzz out there, and we think this is going to generate even more, and maybe give us a better idea of where the direction ought to be.
Senator Cowdery?
Yes. On the facility there at the airport, has that proven to be profitable, or is it?
No. We make no money off a facility like that. A depot like the one in Anchorage or the one in Fairbanks, as soon as we turn the lights on, turn the heater on, it's not profitable. We have a gift shop in the Old Depot, but the depot itself is not a profitable operation. It's heavily used in the summertime. We have not done fare box passenger service yet. I'm looking at this test, this car, maybe is the first start at a regular fare box passenger service. It's possible we could even try something up in Fairbanks like that, if Fairbanks was interested. But the depots are not profit centers. Now, we do lease them out, Senator. I should qualify that. We do lease them out. Helps pay the bills. Helps pay the heat. And we have a facilities manager that takes care of them, because if you have a party or something like, you've got to have people there to take care of the facility. So we're trying to cover our expenses, but we don't make any money.
Thank you.
On slide number 35, you can see some of the folks that we do a lot of business with. We do business smaller leaseholders like the Bridge Restaurant down in Ship Creek. Very nice place to eat. But when they went in there and started building the restaurant, they found out that the pilings underneath the restaurant wouldn't hold the weight of what they wanted to do, and it caused them a real problem at the time. So we basically took that on as our responsibility, and we just swapped the pilings out in that old bridge. I mean, that's what we do to all our other bridges, too. So that was enough to allow them to continue their project and build a nice restaurant, and a lot of people enjoy it today. So we try to work with our customers. Again, we take a long-term view. We'd rather do a partnership and give and take through exchanges in rates or something up front that can be paid back over a long period of time. We're real flexible when it comes to customers, and we've got some new ones on the horizon, like Agrium, the expansion possibly, you know, with Usabelli. Flint Hill's coming back online full up and maybe getting more Pacific customers. We're looking forward to those opportunities. And even with the gas pipeline, in 2001, I sort of hung the banner out there that said we need to be ready for the demands of a gas pipeline whenever it comes without having to push other customers off the railroad. And I'm ready to say we're ready. Build a gas pipeline, we can handle the load, we can move the stuff, and we can handle all our other customers too now. We've come that far.
Are all your bridges up to carrying the pipe?
Just about. Wait. No, we can carry the pipe weight on the bridges we've got now. But in terms of the upgrade of all the bridges, we're well into our bridge upgrade program. So, we can carry the pipe, but we're going to have new bridges, basically, for most of the railroad. And slide number 36, I think the point to make there is at the rate our earnings are going right now, based on the ICER study that we did, had them asked them to do in 2004 about economic impact, the first dot there, we're right now, according to ICER's formula, supporting about 3,000 jobs and $150 million in payroll across the state, above and beyond our own folks. So we are having an economic impact and hopefully going the way the state envisioned when it bought the railroad. Very quickly on slide 38, under the next 6 years, we're looking out ahead at a very robust capital investment program. We've already had in the neighborhood of $350 million during our five-year period. We've put almost $100 million in during that period, but we're ramping up in terms of our contribution and the contribution that we can match to get back from the federal government. So we're going to be able to actually even increase that rate over the next 5 years. And we don't compete with any state projects while we're doing it, fortunately. 2007 capital budget, as you can see, is robust. And then the following slides just are a rundown of what we've got going in the hopper over the next 5 years in terms of the more major projects. The slide 40 talks about the rebuilding the main line. That's really the big one. We talked about technology, and then I kind of break it down as we go up the rail line to some of the regions. You can look and see. Now, this doesn't mean that every single project is fully funded. This means this is what's on the palette. And it's a combination of what we need to do and what we can do and what we want to do. And you kind of got to mix that around year by year as we go forward. The picture on slide 42, just for your information, that used to be one of the tunnels in Healy Canyon. And our guys actually did their earthwork and bypassed that tunnel. And we're in the process of going to be bypassing the other Moody Tunnel, which had a partial collapse last year. You might remember one of the rocks fell on the head of one of my assistant vice presidents. We've really done a lot of work in Healy Canyon. That's our biggest threat area is Healy Canyon. I mean, that whole side just constantly moves toward the river, and so fighting that year to year to year has been a very expensive proposition, but I think we're finally starting to win that one. But you can see Nanana is a big issue, the Northern Rail Extension, Fairbanks, we've got lots of project work in Fairbanks. Usabelli's looking at possible new coal contracts. I mentioned Whittier. We've got a lot of property in Whittier. Linden, we've done a lot of partnering work with Linden down in Whittier. On slide 45, the Mat-Su also, we don't talk about them much, but believe me, we've got some real efforts to try to bypass some of the high traffic areas in the Mat-Su. And then on slide 46, I talked a little bit about trying to ease into commuter rail. One of the things we found is anything you can tack the word intermodal to gets the government's attention. And so we talk a lot about intermodal. Basically, all that really means is that transfer of conveyance from bus to train to truck to barge to ship to plane is the way to go. And so it's a consolidation effort in transportation, and that's a national priority. And so we're trying to follow that in order to keep our federal masters happy as we go forward and argue for money or projects. Number 47 talks a little bit about a regional issue, the Mattsu Ferry. I get questions on that one, so I threw that one in here because it is a regional transportation issue. Right now, the status of that is really it's more of an issue between the city of Anchorage and the Mattsu Borough than it is with a railroad issue. We basically said we'll allow them to come in on railroad property at the end of Ship Creek, and we've stated some conditions which they were willing to meet, and now they're talking to the city of Anchorage about the city's position on this. On a day-to-day basis, on slide 48, these items come up across the entire 500 miles of the railroad. These are the kinds of things we deal with every day, all up and down the rail line. To us, it looks like business as usual, but I guarantee you, to each individual person involved in one of these issues, it's the center point of their life sometimes, depending on how important the issue is to them. Because we actually have, for example, landowners who will buy a piece of land across the railroad track with absolutely no access and then come back and want a crossing. And we can't give it to them. I mean, it's against every policy we've got is to give a crossing. When you say, okay, you know, are you willing to put cross bucks on there and repair the crossing and maintain the crossing and do all this? And they say, well, no. And so we have to deal with that. Unfortunately, there are sellers who will go out and do that and will not and buyers who will not do the due diligence it requires to know whether or not they have access to their own property. So even to an individual, it's really a big deal. And we have many of those that we're dealing with, many of your constituents all up and down the rail line. And for the most part, we can work most of these out. A lot of times it's a matter of convenience rather than a matter of absolute need. Eminent domain, boy, that's one I'd like to stay away from, but we have it. We've never used it. We can use it, but that's a hot button item and one that I would only as an absolute last resort ever want to bring here to Juneau. But we do have it in our toolkit, and that's just for information. If it's in the state's best interests and you all agree, then eminent domain is usable. But we don't throw that one around. And like I said, we've never used it before. Slide 49. We have several issues that we work with both federal and state. SHPO and the Historical Preservation Act is one that's of real interest to us right now. Because the railroad's aged out now, the entire railroad is eligible to be a historical district. And if it's designated a federal historic district, then everything we do on the railroad has to go through the State Historical Preservation Office to get permission. If I bust a window out of one of my shops, I have to go get permission. If I want to repair a piece of track or a bridge, I have to go get permission. We think that's the wrong approach, and we're trying to work with them to find a balance where we recognize and appreciate the need to preserve what's historic, but to declare everything historic seems to be overreaching. That has a state piece to it and a federal piece to it. So that's one that you may hear more about. Homeland security is a growing issue, and we don't know where that's going to go, but so far we're in pretty good shape. And then there are legislative requests, land exchange, bond sales, the things the law, the Transfer Act, says we must come to the legislature and get permission, and we've got a couple in each one of those categories that are there that we can talk about if you're interested. Slide 50, talk a little bit about safety and security. We had TSA come in with an entire team and give us a top to bottom. We were one of the very first, if not the first, railroad this team had ever visited. They told us there were 50,000 TSA airport agents, aviation agents in the system, and there were 90 railroad agents in the U.S. system, and about 20 of them came to visit us. That was a good visit. They left a great report. We got good marks, and we had a great exchange, and we're very, very active in the security side of things, particularly in the use of technology and the investment.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Vegetation management. I know there were some issues, there have been, I guess, continuing over the use of pesticides and the pesticides getting in the salmon streams and other things. What's the current status of you're using pesticides?
Well, there's a long involved process, you know, to get a permit, which we applied for to DEC here in the state. That permit is under consideration by DEC. It's here in Juneau. I don't know how they're going to come down on that, but we've extended the period that normally would be needed to make that determination, because they came back as a result of public input and asked for more information and more data, which we supplied them. And so and then we went through a regime change with the governor changing over and commissioners coming in and out, and everything went in kind of a hold mode there for a while. And so we're waiting to see what the outcome of that request for a permit is. I expect that from what I know of the permit process, it's based on the technical merits. And what they're looking for from the public is, are there things that we've forgotten? And then they make a judgment. I expect that if we get one, it'll be caveated very, very heavily in terms of how we can do it, or where we can do it, or what we can do, based on the reaction that we got. But I don't know what the answer is going to be yet. They haven't tipped their cards yet to us.
Senator Wilkin.
Thank you.
And that has to be renewed every year, by the way, Senator. Yeah.
Thank you.
Are you participating in, or will you participate in, Alaska Land Mobile Radio Program?
Yes, we are. We're very much a partner in that. We have one of our vice presidents who has pretty much represented us, because she is very knowledgeable on this subject from her background and experience, and we're a full-up partner in that.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
That completes the briefing. That's an awful lot, but I mean it's about a mile wide and an inch deep. But I hope I've hit on or at least included in here many of the issues that either now or later you might be able to go back and refer to this, and we'd be happy to come back and talk about them individually in more detail, or with your staffs, or any other forum that you'd like. But that does conclude our presentation today.
I have a couple of quick questions. Could you tell me what your status is as it relates to Senator Stevens and future federal funding?
Yes. With a little bit of background, if I may. When we took stock in 2001 and built the first five-year program, one of the first things we decided was we were never going to be able to continue that forever. Mm-hmm. And we made a strategic move to go to Washington and find out how to get onto the federal formula funds that we were entitled to. There was a lot of resistance to give us satisfaction on that entitlement, but we got it. And the whole idea was to, we put a date out there. We said in 4 years, which was 2006, we wanted to be able to transfer over to the equivalent amount of federal funds in the formula that Senator Stevens was giving us as an earmark every year. In 2007, his earmarks went to zero. 2006, they went from 25 to 10 million. 2007, they went to zero. We made the transfer over, and we're in great shape. But I'm afraid the days of the earmarks and the, at least in the Federal Railroad Administration account administered through them, I think those days are over. Now, on the DOD account, that's another pot that we are eligible for, as we work with Fort Wainwright and we work with the Port of Anchorage and so on. On the DOD account, I think there will still be the opportunity for dollars to come through as a result of Senator Stevens helping out to get appropriations, DOD appropriations into Alaska for the Alaskan military.
Okay. One more question, in case if anybody doesn't, I don't want to waste the committee's time. How would you get one of those trains from Colorado to your line in Alaska?
As you know, there is no rail line connection.
Yeah, right.
So we take the train, we rent time on somebody else's train and track and haul the cars up to Seattle. And then, as I said, we have a dock there in the port of Seattle, and we roll the car right onto one of Linden's barges, which has, they're 400 feet long and 100 feet wide, and they've got about 8 rows of tracks across. And we just roll the cars right onto the tracks. Barge pulls out, comes in, hooks into Whittier, ramp comes down, and we roll it right off onto the tracks on the ramp and up into Whittier.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for the presenter today? No? If not, thank you very much for the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we'll get back to you if we have some future questions or if we'd like you to come again.
Sure.
With that, the committee is at a close, and appreciate the committee's indulgence. And